Okay, you're back with We the People. Our number is 510-848-4425. If you feel you have something to offer to the conversation, 510-848-4425. And if you just want to offer suggestions, give us an email at WTP@WTP.org. My guests today are Miguel Altieri, professor at the University of California in agroecology, and Peter Rossett, the executive director of Food First. Now, I want to, this point may to many listeners seem esoteric, but if I understand what you're saying, and what you're saying really has the ramifications that it sounds like it does, could organic agriculture be put out of business? Or, I mean, how dangerous is it for these corporations to create, I guess, their seeds that have built in them some kind of anti-bug property, and then that anti-bug property will stimulate the evolution of superbugs, as you call them, and then the organic farmers that won't use these seeds because that's not part of the organic procedure, that can they just be totally wiped out, or how bad is it?
Organic farmers can be, in my opinion, be threatened by two main factors. One, the ecological risks of transgenic crops, which is herbicide resistance. They could have weeds that develop that are resistant to all kinds of management techniques. And second, the problem of BT resistance. That is they're going to lose basically the tool. Not the BT transgenic crop, but rather the Bacillus thuringiensis as a spray, as a microbial insecticide, which is the way they're using it today. And the third way that they're going to be affected is that all the varieties that are being developed by corporations with biotechnology are patented. So they will have to pay royalties to the corporations if they grow the seeds of these crops that have been already patented.
And these are all hybrid seeds, right?
They're all hybrid seeds.
So, okay, now let me get this one. What are the seeds that are not hybrid, and what are hybrid, and so what?
Okay, the hybrids are the ones that basically you cannot continue reproducing. You cannot grow from the seed that you harvest the crop the next season.
And why does it have that property?
Because
basically they breed two separate lines that they know that in the first generation when you cross them will have some positive properties, but they plan it through the breeding so that the second generation will be a complete disaster. It's like planned obsolescence in the automobile industry.
Is that necessary to hybridization?
It is not necessary.
It is not necessary.
Is that true?
It's necessary to corporate profits.
Right.
So you're saying you could have a hybrid that you could then save the seed and then keep planting it over and over again. Is that right?
Right.
So hybridization in the corporate world is planned obsolescence, as Peter was saying.
Right. But many of the transgenic crops, they don't necessarily have to be hybrids in the sense that they can be grown again, maybe a second time. But if you're going to grow them, you have to pay royalties.
Right. In fact, hybrids have now become obsolete themselves because they used to have to make hybrids because they couldn't patent seeds. So if it was a hybrid, you'd have to buy it every year because you couldn't reproduce your own seeds. But now that it's legal to patent life forms, they can skip the whole laborious process of making hybrids. They can just sell you regular open pollinated varieties that are patented, and then it's against the law to save the seed and use it unless you pay them their profit.
Okay, now how many farmers are in control of their own seeds?
Well, most of the traditional farmers in the third world are still in control of their own seeds.
What about in the United States? What about in California or Iowa?
I have no idea.
Very few farmers use seeds that they don't purchase. Very few.
So there's no saving your seed corn for the next...
Well, there is some of that. And sometimes what people will do is they'll save it and reuse it for 2 or 3 years and then buy more seed. As sometimes the quality can decline depending on the practices they use on their farm. But what the patenting does is it really enforces the need to buy, and it also allows companies to charge a much higher price, just like with drugs. When a drug is patented, they get windfall profits because nobody else can produce that variety. When the patent runs out, it becomes much cheaper. So as they patent the crop varieties, the price that farmers have to pay goes way up.
Now, you're saying, Miguel, at the university, you're saying a lot of the research is coming from corporate investments that are geared to biotechnology and the advancement of the corporate interest.
Well, it's not different from what the story of Van den Bosch when he wrote his book, The Pesticide Conspiracy.
By the way, I bet a lot of people have never heard of Give me his name again.
Robert van den Bosch.
And he wrote a book called The Pesticide.
Yeah, he was a professor at Berkeley for many years on biological control, one of the pioneers. We did have a division of biological control that has been now closed.
Biological control is alternatives to pesticides.
Right. And he was one of the leaders of that. And he wrote a book called The Pesticide Conspiracy, where he documented how the pesticide companies back in the 70s and early 80s funded all the research that was going on in pest control in the university. Now, with the advent of biotechnology, a lot of corporations, private donors, are giving money to the universities, not only California, but all the universities throughout the world. And basically, they are calling the shots in terms of the research agenda.
So in terms of encouraging people to do their own food growing, urban farming, that's just not a priority, either the corporation, obviously, or the university itself, which has now become the tool.
Universities are under incredible pressure right now to become privatized or to self-produce their own income so that they can function independently, and therefore they are not being, in my opinion, accountable to the public in general. And supposedly, University of California is a public university, land-grant university that should be devoted to the interests of all farmers, not only the large-scale farmers.
Okay, let's take a call from Akiva.
Yes, thank you. Hi, Jerry, and hi, Miguel, and Peter. I feel that it's very fitting that I get to speak with you gentlemen today. This summer, I should say, I am the Sustainable Agriculture Program Manager at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, and have had a chance to hear about permaculture at We the People this summer, and to grow out at the Gill Tract, and am very much encouraged and inspired by the work that's happening up in the Bay Area, and feel that there is an openness at the university where I work to a lot of these things that we're discussing. And I would like to hear some recommendations on what is needed from a program such as ours, one of the largest undergraduate agricultural programs in the nation, so that we can integrate this awareness into curriculum and community offerings that we have.
Who wants to take a hand at that?
Well, I think that Miguel is a pioneer at working with a lot of universities, unfortunately most outside the United States, in completely restructuring their agriculture curriculum. You have to go away from the compartmentalization of where we just study the soil here, the water in another class, the irrigation, the mechanization in another, and get a more holistic view of agriculture. And that means that agroecological principles have to be put throughout the different agriculture course offerings. And I would strongly suggest getting Miguel as a consultant on that.
Well, more than that, I think what we should do is network and maybe think about get in touch through email or something to think about how we can link the different programs that are going on, like yours and Berkeley, Santa Cruz, and so on, and how can we perhaps link in try to cross-learn and organize a conference, California-wide conference on this, so that we can share experiences and advance.
Do you have a web page?
Yes, I have a web page, but my email is agroeco3@nature.berkeley.edu.
You better say that one again.
Agroeco, A-G-R-O-E-C-O, 3, mm-hmm. The number, at nature.berkeley.edu.
And while we're at it, I'll mention the Food First webpage is a lot simpler, www.foodfirst.org.
You know what? We may just link this to the We the People webpage, and it'll be very easy for people to find. And we do that with all these shows. We put information about our guests. So that's another reason why you want to note our webpage, which is WTP.org with three W's in front. All right. Let's go to Mark in Houston, Texas.
Hello.
Hey,
hello.
Mark.
This is Mark Bowen. I'm with a group in the Houston area called Urban Harvest, and we are an organic agriculture organization. I'd like to encourage all of your listeners to think about joining or starting local groups. For example, our group, we have a seed bank where we preserve heirloom open pollinated seeds and make them available to the community. We have a library with organic agriculture resources. We have a school and youth program. We have about 60 to 70 classes that we teach per year. In the state of Texas, the university systems are not addressing organic agriculture on any substantive basis. And so there are people in various cities that have formed alternative agriculture groups. And this last week we've had our first statewide conference and brought in organizers from all over the state, and we're trying to do what we can on an alternative way, on an alternative basis, and get this education out there. I just want to encourage people to think about not only tapping into university systems, which is important. We have to work with university systems and do what we can with them, but in situations where there's a gap, I would encourage people to think about starting their own groups or joining existing groups and trying to get these.
Okay, Mark, do you have anything on the Internet?
We do have a web page, and...
Well, why don't you send me an email, and we'll find a way to link it up to our webpage.
That sounds wonderful.
That's much easier. And we're WTP at WTP.org. So anybody who wants to, you know, keep this, build this network, if you go through the webpage, because I know we've already thrown out a few numbers, and I'm going to throw out another one, which becomes a blur after a while, particularly people driving on the freeway.
But seed-saving networks are very important. In Latin America, we have a lot of them. We call them in-situ conservation projects.
Okay, Mark, thank you very much. And I better mention here the Urban Agricultural Education Day at the Gill Tract, which is September 13th, 1997, 10 to 2. You can share and learn practical skills in urban gardening, raised bed gardens, worm farming, composting, starting seedlings, alternatives to pesticides, double digging, all the rest of it. Where's the Gill Track?
It's at the corner of Buchanan and San Pablo Avenue in Albany on September 13th.
Say it again.
The corner of Buchanan Street and San Pablo Avenue in Albany in the East Bay. And that's on September 13th from 10 to 2. We hope to see you there.
Okay. Now, when I see double digging, I think of French intensive gardening. I think of John Jevons. What about that? Now, Jevons, who I've had on the show a while back, has a rather pessimistic view that says because we don't put back into the soil what is taken out, there is massive depletion going on, even in organic agriculture.
It's possible that if some organic farmers are not managing right their biomass and their inputs into the soils of organic matter, obviously they're going to run into that problem. But our approach combines approaches of many people. John Jevons' gardening techniques are welcome, and we respect his work, and we incorporate the best of every approach.
Let me ask you this, Miguel. Are you optimistic or pessimistic?
I'm optimistic.
About the future?
I'm very optimistic about the future in the sense of when I see these lighthouses. I'm actually going right now tonight to Dominican Republic, where we're working with 2,500 farmers that have conserved their soils in the hillsides. They cannot go back to the valleys because they have been displaced by the large sugarcane corporations. But in the hillsides, they have adopted agroecological methods. And so when I see those examples, when we go to Cuba, when we go to Africa and see what's happening, for example, in Mali, where they are recuperating deserts and so on, I see a lot of hope. And this is what I call the pockets of resistance that are going to become the lighthouses of hope.
Okay. Now, in California, we had a fellow, I'm talking now about the Central Valley from Fresno coming north to Sacramento. We had a professor from Davis who said that within 25 years, the breadbasket of California will be like Southern California around Los Angeles, basically subdivisions and minimal agriculture.
Well, urban agriculture is very important. We ought to start as we plan urban growth. We ought to plan for agricultural areas in cities. We keep coming back to this over and over again. We have to abandon this false dichotomy between city and farm and begin to integrate both of them.
Okay, but Peter, I want to get a response here. If in fact the present development, suburbanization, paving over is going to reduce California food production, is that a problem, or will biotech bail us out, or will we start growing food in the abandoned urban areas while people move to the suburbs?
First of all, the Central Valley is the semi-desert that is going to collapse anyway if it continues being farmed the way it is, because of salinization, because of pesticide resistance, because of many ecological problems that are already showing the tip of the iceberg. So it's going to collapse if we don't change that system.
So people are buying desert homes now. They don't know it.
They don't know.
With contaminated groundwater.
If it becomes totally paved, one aspect would be to go into urban agriculture. But the addition is that because of globalization, really doesn't matter anymore where people are getting their food. I mean, it will come from somewhere else. And on the other hand, We can also expand agricultural production into new areas, for example, Northern California, where we can use ecological methods of production.
All right. Well, I don't know if we can get her because she just called in, but I thought maybe a comment from Pamela from Fresno. We have to adjust our technology here to do that. Fresno is a very long way from Berkeley.
Yeah, I don't want to suggest that we're in favor of urban expansion.
Yes, Jerry, I'd like your guest to address hydroponics. It has increased productivity and deals with water conservation.
Okay, Pamela, let's try that. We've got 40 seconds, so...
Hydroponics is a very artificial system where plants are growing in these mediums of nutrients. And basically, it's, in my opinion, it's totally isolated from the real ecosystemic way in which you should be growing crops. So it has potential to grow crops in desert areas, in marginal areas, but I have doubts about the quality of the food and about the way the food is being produced.
Amory Levins was on the show a few weeks ago, and he says he grows, he's very proud of the bananas that he grows up in Crestline, Colorado, or anyway, it's in the mountains of Colorado, and he has his glass enclosed thing. Is that good or bad?
Well, you can grow food in many, many ways. You can grow them even probably in a closet if you put some kind of a radiation that is.
But he doesn't have any electricity. He's using all
it's
sun
fine.
Conservation.
I just don't know about the quality of the food in terms of nutritionally.
I see. Okay, well, that's a good point. All right, that winds it up. September 13th, if you're around Albany.
At the corner of Buchanan and San Pablo Avenue.
Show up for
Urban
some interesting
Ag Field
stuff
Day.
On Urban Ag Field Day. So Miguel Altieri and Peter Rossett, thank you very much for illuminating us about food production. And all of you, as you get ready for the Labor Day weekend, think about it as you eat tonight. And what are you growing and what are you depending on others for? Good night.